BookTheBook.com.
Hello, what's up, everybody? Thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, February 22nd edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We're over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me on this hump day edition of the show. I'm going to talk some Major League Baseball, also some NHL here at the top of the broadcast. Second half of today's show, our Wednesday Wagering with Wes Reynolds segment. We'll chat with him about the NBA, college basketball, and then also take a deep dive into this week's Honda Classic at PGA National, going down to the Sunshine State. And I'm sure the players are really hoping for some sunshine here after some really waterlogged tournaments out in the state of California. So a lot of good stuff coming your way here on today's show. Coming up on Thursday, we'll have our Thursday meeting show, Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com. Also, Ralph Michaels from WagerTalk.com. And then we'll see what Friday's broadcast has in store. But I have a ton of things to talk about here at today's show. Over at Bet Online Sportsbook. So if you have an account over at Bet Online, you can start to take a look at some of those. We'll see who opens up next out there in the marketplace offshore, trying to catch up on everything here this morning and see if anybody else has posted anything. But we're in a situation now where we've got some numbers. We've got a frame of reference. So what that does in terms of my timeline with my MLB season win totals, I still have to wait because I want to make sure that everybody has access to these, or at least, you know, I have a reasonable sample size of books. So probably looking for at least two or three more offshores to open before I start posting these. My guess is that I'll start rolling them out here next Monday. Be a good way to start off the week. It'll give me these 3 days here this week, and then, of course, over the weekend to work on some of these. I've got 10 done so far, the American League East and the American League Central. I'll keep going through those. But a few things I want to discuss here as it pertains to win totals and sort of the mindset and the process that you want to go through. For me, I don't know necessarily if jumping on the openers is the best idea. Now, first of all, it's February 22nd. By the way, it's the 37th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice, if you didn't know that. But it's February 22nd. Nobody has played a spring training game yet. We've got the World Baseball Classic this year, and there are a lot of players on a lot of Major League Baseball teams that will be participating in this thing. So I don't know if it's in your best interest right now to jump headfirst into the MLB season win total market if you have an account at BetOnline or whenever one of the other offshores opens. A lot of things can go wrong between now and the start of the season. Now, of course, you know, you want to get out there in front of the market. You want to get out there and grab the best numbers. But I really don't think that there's a whole lot of sharp action coming on these until probably the middle of March, I would say. Mid to late March is when we start to see some movement on these. Position battles have been decided. All the remaining free agents have been inked. You know who's healthy and who's not. You feel a lot more comfortable here in about a month or so, certainly at least in 3 weeks, in terms of how teams are going to look when they head into the season. You know, you still have a lot of the people out there using a good chunk of their bankroll on college basketball. Conference tournaments are very, very busy in terms of betting the futures market, betting those games, that type of thing. So there's a lot of stuff to occupy your money with before we really need to take a deep dive into all of these numbers. So I think it's in your best interest to sit and wait it out a little bit. You know, I mean, think about it. If Clayton Kershaw winds up with some elbow pain here in a couple weeks, and I'll definitely knock on wood for that because Dodgers fan or not, he's one of the best pitchers we've ever seen in Major League Baseball, and you want him around. You want to be able to watch a guy like that. But if he has some elbow pain or maybe his back flares up again, which is something that he had happen last year, the Dodgers at 94.5 wins, if Clayton Kershaw is only making half of his scheduled starts or maybe even two-thirds of his scheduled starts, you really start to worry about a season win total like that. So I don't think that there's any reason to dive in here right away. I'm trying to get these win totals done in a timely manner so that you can take a look at these things, that you can plan a little bit. But, you know, hey, it happens. I mean, I've put these things out in late February, early March before. All of a sudden somebody gets hurt, winds up being a bad one because it was a really significant player that got hurt. But also for anybody that followed along, anybody that had invested to begin with, you know, you're kind of SOL in a situation like that. So I don't think there's any reason to dive in right away. you know, I talked about this a little bit in the piece I put up yesterday at bangthebook.com. I wrote this up in a little bit of a hurry comparing the Westgate numbers and the Atlantis numbers. You know, I don't think that there's going to be, you know, a ton of stuff here in terms of, you know, movement on these so far. We certainly saw an initial wave of action up in Atlantis, and I have no idea what those numbers moved to. I didn't see anything that was updated, but I imagine some of the numbers from Westgate shaded a little bit based on some of that Atlantis action. Other numbers at Westgate shaded because you've got proximity of teams to Las Vegas, where, you know, the California team is probably a little bit inflated. We use one as an example here, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Now, this is a team that Pecota and Steamer, two of the projection systems out there, like a lot more than what the opening number in Atlantis was of 76.5. That number comes out 80.5 at Westgate. Now, I think it's a fairer number. And as I was sort of going through, I haven't written the Angels one yet, but as I was going through and looking at some of the projections and looking at how things finished up last year, you know, I thought at 76.5, it was a low number in Anaheim. Now we get an 80.5. That's closer to where it should be. And of course, like I said, proximity to California is a big deal. You know, you're going to have people out in California that come out to Vegas. They're going to want to bet some of these things. You know, so you shade stuff like that. Take a team like the Yankees, for example. The Yankees opened 83.5 at both Atlantis and Westgate offshore. Maybe they open a little bit differently because, you know, the offshore market's going to cater to a different kind of bettor. Interestingly enough, the Yankees are 82.5 at BetOnline, but the over minus 125. So keep in mind here, you have some public teams that are going to be shaded a little bit out there in the offshore market. For example, I think the Dodgers may be a little bit high at 94.5. That's not to say I'd play back on the under, but they're a very public team. You know, Boston, 92.5. Could they do it? Absolutely. Very public team. The juice on the under is now minus 130 at BetOnline. So that's something that you want to sort through as well out there in the offshore market is, you know, have an understanding of which teams are very public, which teams they're going to shade the juice on. But ultimately, what I really wanted to talk about here today is that I don't think anybody needs to go crazy jumping in on these right now. I think you've got plenty of time to wait around. I think a lot of these numbers are going to stay in the range that they're currently at. You know, there will be some market movement. Let's say, you know, the Nationals, let's say that the Max Scherzer finger injury winds up being something more significant than it appears to be right now. If you want to try to get out in front of the market before that one, you certainly could. You know, if you read on Twitter that some key player is going for an MRI on a knee or on an elbow or a shoulder, by all means, you know, look for opportunities to get edges, look for opportunities to get the best price when you can. But also, I think it's in your best interest when you're going to have money tied up for 6 months that, you know, you have an idea of what these teams are going to look like once we actually start the season. You know, I mean, take Arizona, for example. If Paul Goldschmidt goes down, that's a terrible team. That's a 70-win team. Right now, their season win total is sitting 77.5 out there at Westgate, 77 in the offshore market at BetOnline. You know, those things generally don't happen. You're probably safer than, you know, this doomsday scenario would suggest. But again, I don't think there's really any reason to go out there and go crazy. Now, I'll say this. You know, a movement of a win, a movement of a win and a half, pretty significant here when it comes to these win totals. You know, a lot of them, as I've been tracking these over the last 3 years, a lot of them do come down to that final week. Sometimes you do get some situations where, you know, you have a team like Minnesota, for example, last year, who was just awful from the outset, awful at the end of the year. That was one that we had in our pockets, you know, by the end of May. Sometimes that happens. A lot of times it doesn't. A lot of times these things do go all the way to the end of the season. So, yeah, they're pretty sharp numbers overall, but you're talking about 162-game sample size. There can be a lot of variance in there. So I think that if you wait 2, 3, 4 weeks, you're going to be just fine. And maybe you do lose one that moves out of a range that you're comfortable with. It happens. It is what it is. But I think the smart thing to do here is to wait these things out. Make sure everybody's healthy, see if there are any additional free agent signings, all that type of stuff, especially again with the World Baseball Classic this year. You know, you got to be very careful because some premier players are participating in that event. And if they go down, you know, I mean, it's different, you know, it's different than playing a spring training game. You're trying to work on things. You know, we'll see starts in spring training. Pitchers will throw nothing but fastballs because they're solely working on fastball command. When you go to the World Baseball Classic, you're not doing that. You're mixing your pitches. You're going from 0 to 100, basically, or maybe 25 or 30 to 100 in terms of, you know, your effort level, your output. That's something that can be very, very worrisome for a lot of teams. And, you know, these players want to win. You know, they're playing for national pride, especially when you talk about players from Latin American countries, really anybody outside the U.S. Not to say that there's not pride in playing for the U.S., but you know, you're used to playing on the big stage. You play in Major League Baseball. If you're, you know, somebody that plays in the Dominican, you're somebody that plays in the Korean League or the Japanese League, it's really significant to play in the World Baseball Classic. You know, if you're playing for Canada, I mean, Canada, one thing we know about Canada, there's a ton of national pride up there, and we see it all the time in any of their events, whether it's professional teams or the Olympics or World Juniors, anything like that. You know, it's a significant event for that country. So these players are going to be putting out max effort, and some of them may not be in the state to do it. So I certainly think that there's no harm in waiting. I'm going to keep repeating that over and over again here on today's segment and as we go throughout. You know, I think that it's in your best interest to make sure that you know what you're working with before you actually take that jump and dive in. But a couple of things I do want to mention here, at least in terms of initial leans, I did see some stuff here, you know, in terms of the differences between the two books. You look at something, for example, like that Angels move, you know, that goes from an over lean to a no play. The Kansas City Royals were another one. You know, Jonah Carey writes a good over-under piece. I love Jonah Carey. Don't get me wrong. I think Jonah Carey does phenomenal work. His podcast on the Nerdist Network is really good. His, you know, national work for CBS Sports is outstanding. I've read him everywhere he's been, and I will continue to. But he posted his over-under win totals piece when only Atlantis was open. His top play was Kansas City under. Now, at that point, Kansas City was under 80.5. When I started writing up Kansas City yesterday, I thought, man, there's no way in hell this is a 500 team. Well, guess what? Westgate comes out 74.5. So now that really shifts to a no play for me. I mean, truthfully, I think there's a chance it could still go under, but I don't have that margin that I'm looking for anymore in terms of the Royals win total. So, you know, you get these things here. Some of these books are going to open different numbers. I think right now with Westgate, the market is set. So there are a couple that I'm looking at here. You know, there are certainly ones that are on my radar. I think the Chicago White Sox at 68.5 wins, that's one I like. The over in that one, 69.5 at BetOnline, which is not a very nice number for us. But you know, that's what I'm looking at because the process that I go through here in terms of looking at these season win totals, I want to evaluate the team's floor, the team's ceiling, and then I want to incorporate the number into how close I think it is to the floor or the ceiling. Now, look, Chicago's in an interesting spot. They're in a rebuild. Jose Quintana is going to be traded at some point here this season. So you make that play full knowing that Quintana's probably going to be on the move, probably going to go to a contender in July. Houston maybe would be a team that would fit. Texas, if they can put together the prospects to get him. There are going to be a lot of suitors for Jose Quintana, and it's in Rick Hahn's best interest to move him. They've already moved Chris Sale. They've already moved Adam Eaton. But as I was going through, I see a lot of young players that have upside, both in the lineup and in the starting rotation, in the upper levels of the minor leagues. So even though Chicago may look a lot different come September than they do now, I think the 68.5 number is a lot closer to their floor than it is to their ceiling. So that would be a play where I would kind of look toward the over. So that's my thought process there with that one. Of course, you'll be able to read that right up when I post it next week. But the White Sox were definitely one I was looking at. San Diego, you know, this is one of those where I think that proximity to California kind of plays a little bit of a role. It's hard to lose 100 games in Major League Baseball. It is very, very difficult. The Atlantis number had San Diego at 64.5, which would be, you know, about 97.5 losses, 98 losses. That's a lot of losses. The number at Westgate comes out 67.5, and you have to look at this in terms of the relative strength of the rest of the division because teams do play 76 of their 162 games against division foes, and I'll talk about that in a second here with another team. But you've got the Dodgers, who have the highest win, who have the second highest win total in the National League, 94.5. You've got the Giants, who are always knocking on the door of a playoff berth. You've got the Rockies, a team that a lot of people seem to like this year. There's a lot of steam out there for them. Their season win total is sitting here at 80.5. And then the Diamondbacks, who are in the 78 range. You know, they've got guys like A.J. Pollock and Paul Goldschmidt, who are two really good guys to build around. Zach Greinke should be in line for a bounce-back season, I would think. Somebody in this division has to lose. Obviously, from the win total numbers, San Diego would be that team. I think there's a good chance San Diego's a 100-loss team. Their rotation is atrociously bad. Their lineup has some decent young pieces and parts, but you know, they're also a team that is in a rebuilding phase. So if anybody does step up, somebody that's a rental or some kind of veteran player, they'll be gone at some point. So I think that's one of those where the number was adjusted a little bit too high, you know, thinking that they're so close to California and people are going to want to come and make their homer bet on their team. On the flip side, you could argue that, you know, maybe the number is where it should be, because a lot of Padres fans know it's going to be a long year. So you want to read between the lines on some of these things. You want to see if there are some opportunities to play on perception. And I think that there certainly are, including one here in the American League West. Now, the Oakland Athletics opened 66.5 at Atlantis, which was way too low. No question about it, it was way too low. The adjusted number at Westgate, 74.5. But look at the rest of the American League West. Houston, 91.5 wins. Seattle, 85.5 wins. Texas, 84.5. Anaheim, who I mentioned already, 80.5. The projection systems really like their rotation. Somebody has to lose in the American League West. Oakland has put together a piecemeal roster. I think they're hoping for a bounce back from Sonny Gray. They think Jarrell Cotton could be a really bona fide middle of the rotation piece. Sean Manaea looked really good last year at the end of the year. Oakland has some pieces, but do they have enough pieces to win 75 games in a division like this where they play everybody 19 times? I don't know. Those are things that you have to try to figure out as you look through these season win totals. Those are some of the questions that I look to answer in my write-ups, which again, I'll try to get out here starting early next week, just so you have an idea of what I'm looking at and also get a little bit of a feel for some of these teams. You know, these are also articles that can help you in a big way from a fantasy baseball standpoint. Maybe you don't do a lot of MLB handicapping. Maybe you're not going to put a whole lot of money into these win totals, but there are some players here, because one of the things I like to look for is surplus value. I look for value under the surface that people aren't really accounting for. And so those are players that could be sleepers for you, whether it's across, you know, a full MLB league or an AL only or an NL only, something like that. There will be some fantasy baseball type stuff in here as well for you. So these are multifaceted write-ups that I do, you know, both for, you can even incorporate some of it into daily fantasy as well. So really proud of what I do with these. And again, I'll probably start rolling them out here next week once we get a wider sample size of books with some season win total stuff. But very happy to be talking baseball here on the show. If you ever have a baseball question, please feel free to reach out on Twitter at Skating Tripods, or you can reach out to the main at Bang the Book Twitter account. So I had a question here, and this is something that I want to look into a little bit, see if I can cover value here. Somebody on Twitter asked our Bang the Book Twitter feed about NHL futures, if there was anything that I thought had some value. A few things that you need to keep in mind here about the NHL. Recently, with realignment, they've changed the playoff format. So what happens is the top three teams in each division are guaranteed a playoff spot. Then there are two wild card spots in each conference that go to the teams with the next highest point totals. So for example, what we have coming up here in the first round for the Eastern Conference playoffs, at least as of now, we would have the New York Rangers, who have 78 points, opening on the road against the Montreal Canadiens, who have 72 points, because Montreal is going to win the Atlantic Division, or at least they should. Ottawa's 3 points back, Toronto's 5 points back, Florida's 6 points back. We'll see what happens. I think with Claude Julien, Montreal is safe to win this division, but they draw a really tough opponent in the first round. So the NHL is trying to figure out if there's something that they can do about this, because think about it. You know, in a traditional sense, Montreal would be playing a much weaker opponent than the New York Rangers. The Rangers are a better team. If you look at the body of work, if you look at everything New York has done this year, they're a better team. Meanwhile, a team like Ottawa, for example, gets to play Toronto if the playoffs started today. So that's something you want to look at here as you look in terms of the futures market, you know, sort of projecting what some of these first round matchups could be, who plays who, will they be at home? You know, home road splits are very significant in the NHL because The road team gets the last, or the home team gets the last change. That's a big deal. That's a big advantage that's built in here for these teams in the postseason. But as far as the NHL futures market goes, I think it's pretty challenging at this stage of the game, you know, to look at some of these teams and really look to find some value. Right now, looking across the marketplace here, these numbers are kind of all over the map. But at DSI Sportsbook, the Washington Capitals are plus 510 to win the Stanley Cup. They are the favorites to do that. At Five Dimes, they're plus 475. I bet online, they're plus 400. So the best number out there right now at DSI. For me, I think Washington is the best team in the NHL. You know, I watch them on a regular basis. I've become a Capitals fan dating back to when I saw Alexander Ovechkin in the World Juniors. And I just like the way the organization is run. I like the way the team plays. But as any Capitals fan will tell you, they're a great regular season team, and they're not a good playoff team at all whatsoever. They've had all sorts of playoff disappointments. Furthermore, what's going to happen with Washington here is they're probably going to run into Pittsburgh in the second round. So that's not a good spot, because Pittsburgh, probably the second best team in the Eastern Conference by a decent margin. And, you know, that's going to be a big time challenge for Washington. It's what happened to them last year. They couldn't get past Pittsburgh. That was the end of it for them. Pittsburgh went on, won the Stanley Cup. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind here as well. Is you want to look for the teams that should have the easiest path for you to hedge. You know, take a team like Montreal, for example. If they did happen to beat the Rangers, they would go back into divisional play and play whoever wins, you know, the series between Ottawa and Toronto, or Ottawa and Florida, or whatever the case may be. They're not playing Washington, Pittsburgh, or Columbus. You know, they're playing somebody within their own division. So I think in terms of that, the Atlantic division is where you want to look. The team that I would look to invest in right now, and we're actually getting a pretty good number and a couple of different shops on this team, is the Florida Panthers. The Florida Panthers are plus 4,250 at DSI. They're plus 4,500 at Five Dimes, only plus 2,800 at BetOnline. So again, shop around for the best price. But the Florida Panthers are a much, much different team with Jonathan Huberdeau and Alexander Barkov back in the lineup. This is a team that just swept a five-game road trip. They won all five of them, and it included a trip out west. They've won eight of their last 10. You know, this is a team that was – it had a lot of bad injury luck early on in the year. Nick Bjugstad also missed some time. They do have some goaltending questions, but Roberto Luongo and James Reimer have both been starting netminders in their careers. I don't know if one of them can carry this team, but what I do know is that they're very undervalued still with Huberdeau and Barkov back. So I think Florida, if you can catch them in this 40-1 type of range, 45-1 at Five Dimes, 42-50 at DSI, they are a team that I would definitely look at. I think they match up pretty well with Montreal. Right? They match up fairly well with the teams in the Metropolitan Division. But the nice thing is, if you're sitting on a 42 or 45-1 shot in the NHL playoffs, you know, I think they get into a top three spot in the Atlantic, which if they do, they would avoid playing, you know, Washington, which is great. If you can avoid playing Washington, that's a really, really big deal. If they get into a top three spot, which I think they will, and honestly, I think they finish second in this division, if not win it, you know, they get home ice then at that point. They're going to be playing a weaker opponent. Then you get into a position where if they win that series and they can beat Montreal or whoever else, then you're sitting possibly in the conference finals with a really good 40-1 ticket and a team that, depending on who they play, probably going to be, I would say, a, you know, maybe plus 250 type of underdog in the conference finals. So even if you have to lay $3 or maybe $3.50 on Washington or Pittsburgh or whoever the case may be, you still have some pretty good hedging value there. So I think Florida, unquestionably for me, the top team from a futures standpoint to take a look at here in the Eastern Conference. They're peaking at the right time. They're healthy at the right time. Also, I think they have some opportunities to make some trades if they want to. Like, they have the ability to get a little bit stronger. And you know, we probably lost a little bit of value. I didn't happen to look at this price point before Huberdeau came back, but probably lost a little bit of value, but I think there's still some out there on the Florida Panthers. So that would be the team that I would look at there in the Atlantic Division. And another team I think I would take a smaller position on, I think that there's some value here on this team, the New York Rangers. New York Rangers, you can catch them plus 1,200, plus 1,300 out there in the market. If they draw Montreal by finishing fourth in the Metropolitan Division, I think they win that series. If they move into third and play Pittsburgh, that's a little bit more challenging. So, you know, you got to sort of weigh the risk reward there in terms of, you know, where they may finish in the standings. But if they do end up playing Montreal, I think they win that series, and then you're sitting on a fairly decent ticket for them to play somebody in the second round. It's not as advantageous of a position for you, but the Rangers are really good, and they're also the best road team in the Eastern Conference. They're 19-8 on the road. Nobody else has more than 16 wins on the road among Eastern Conference teams. So the Rangers have played very well away from home. Depth is a big reason why. So maybe there's a little bit of value there in the Rangers. They have two very capable goaltenders in Henrik Lundqvist and Antti Raanta, so they could play either one of them in the playoffs. That gets a nice luxury, and something you want to keep in mind here as well. Teams that have goaltending depth are in pretty good shape come playoff time, because the guys that have to go out there and play 68 or 70 games, they're burned out by the time they get to the playoffs. You know, Martin Jones was a little bit of an exception last year. Look at what Pittsburgh did with Matt Murray. You know, Matt Murray was a guy who was up basically half the season and then all of a sudden roared into the playoffs and led them to the Stanley Cup. You know, if you've got a team that has a balanced goaltending setup where they can use the backup a little bit more frequently, if that's something that really works out in your favor. So I think that's an angle that you want to look at there as you're determining some of your NHL futures. Moving over to the Western Conference, this is a much more difficult conference to figure out because there are three teams to me that stand out way above everybody else: Minnesota, Chicago, and San Jose. Now, as I mentioned, Chicago, you know, doesn't rate particularly well from the advanced metrics, but this is a very, very deep team. It's an extremely experienced team. They have two capable goaltenders in Corey Crawford and Scott Darling, which is something Minnesota doesn't have. Minnesota has to rely heavily on Devan Dubnyk. Darcy Kuemper doesn't play a ton. Bruce Boudreau is trying to use him a little bit more, sort of called him out before the All-Star break, and he's played pretty well in the games where he has made an appearance. But Dubnyk is going to be ridden very hard the rest of the way while Minnesota tries to get this top seed. Similarly for San Jose, Aaron Dell doesn't play a ton. Martin Jones plays a lot. Martin Jones had that long playoff run last year, so back-to-back years with long playoff runs could be kind of problematic, could be kind of challenging for him. So I think those are two teams that I really like, but you know, goaltending depth is a little bit of a worry. That being said, look at the odds out here. San Jose plus 950 at DSI Sportsbook, plus 1,500 at Five Dimes. Chicago is plus 785 at Five Dimes, plus 755 at DSI. Minnesota, well up there on the board. But again, a big price difference, plus 475 at Five Dimes, plus 755 at DSI. So in the Western Conference, I don't see a ton of value. I mean, if you wanted to, you could maybe throw a flyer on Edmonton in the plus 20, plus 22 range. I don't think that they have what it takes, though. They're a very young team. They're still trying to figure things out defensively. I don't know if Cam Talbot can be that guy. And again, he's another guy that doesn't have, you know, a whole lot of support. Maybe Anaheim is a team you look at, but the odds aren't very good on Anaheim to be sitting third in the Pacific Division right now. Anaheim's 12-1 at DSI. They're a little bit better, 22-1 out there at Five Dimes. Maybe that's a look. Maybe the St. Louis Blues at 25-1 at Five Dimes. They're sitting at plus 2,200 at DSI. Maybe they're an option, but I don't see a whole lot I love in the Western Conference here. You know, I think those three teams really stand out above the rest of the competition. Now, of course, the trade deadline is coming up, so some teams could make some pretty significant improvements. That's something that you'll want to keep in mind here. But, you know, for me, I just think that the West is too top-heavy. I think there are additional options in the East because you've got a pretty top-heavy Metropolitan Division to the point where you could make a play on Florida there in that 40-1 range. Keep in mind, this is a Florida team that won the Atlantic Division last year. So this is a team that, you know, at full strength is one of the best in the NHL. I think they're probably a top six or top seven team in the NHL at full strength, as long as one of their goaltenders is playing well. So there's some margin for profit there with Florida, as long as things play out in their favor. You know, I do think they move up the division standings. So if you're looking for one futures play to latch on to in the NHL, I think Florida would be the one. I think in terms of other teams, I just don't know if there's enough margin. I don't know if there's enough hedging ability. you know, to go in and take really any of the chalky teams here at this stage of the game. And hey, in a best of seven, anything can happen too. So, you know, you want to look for some of those longer shot prices. It's hard to play anything below a 20-1 type of number here, I would think. So Florida would be the team that I would look at in the NHL from a future standpoint right now. But beyond that, you know, we'll wait and see how things shake out with the trade deadline. Also see if there are any situations where, you know, some of these teams make some significant strides, or maybe some of those teams in the hunt decide to be sellers and sort of play on that market, because you know, there could be some opportunities out there for that. But I mentioned, there was a comparison there of some of the odds at DSI, Five Dimes, Bet Online, all that type of stuff. Got to be able to shop around for the best prices, no matter what it is, whether it's futures, whether it's game, you know, straight betting, spreads, totals, whatever. Got to shop around, get those best prices. If you don't have an account over at DSI Sportsbook, I would certainly recommend one. You can use the promo code BTB Radio. It'll get you a $10 free bet just for signing up, and then an additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. I'll try to talk a little bit about some of these NHL situational spots as we get closer to the weekend. Throughout the week here, I haven't seen too many really good ones. There are a few coming up here on the weekend, but one thing I do want to point out before I bring Wes on the show here, the bye week thing is getting a lot of press now in NHL media circles. You know, I saw an article over at ESPN from Craig Custance about how the Players Association and the league is trying to figure this thing out, because there's been such a big disparity of teams, you know, playing poorly in that first game back out of the bye against teams that have been playing regularly. So NHL's talking about solutions to update the schedule. So that angle may be burned a little bit for us now. You know, obviously that's a change that'll be implemented next year, but teams are fully aware of what's happening to teams coming off the bye. Teams are fully aware of what's happening going into the bye. Take Minnesota last night as an example. Minnesota going into the bye, playing a rival in Chicago. Chicago dominated that game. It was not nearly as close as the 5-3 score would indicate. So, you know, some of these trends are kind of reversing a little bit here. There was some small sample size variance. We certainly should have expected that, but may not be as strong of an angle for us going forward. So again, use proper discretion. Make sure that you're thinking about everything with a general perspective, as opposed to just tunnel vision and narrowing your focus, because that's what you get into a lot of trouble here in this industry. Whew. All right. We'll go ahead and bring on today's first and only guest for our Wednesday wagering segment. That is Mr. Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Going well, Adam. That sounded like a lot to get through there, what you were just saying.
It was. There was. I had a lot of talking points here for the start of today's show, so I'm glad I was able to get through all of them, and now I can share the airwaves a little bit with you. Let's go ahead and start with the Honda Classic. We'll go down to the Sunshine State here at PGA National. One of the things I was talking about in the intro to today's show is, hey, maybe we'll actually get some decent weather now, finally.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you may get a little bit of rain today, but that'll just firm up the course. I mean, it's not something where I expect really huge low scores here. I mean, this ranks as one of the fifth toughest courses, or it was in the top five on toughest courses three of the last 4 years. So this is going to be one of the more challenging events, regular tour events that these guys are going to play. But yeah, I don't think. It sounds like the wind is going to be just breezy. I mean, the wind can be brutal where this is located in Palm Beach Gardens. So it doesn't sound like the wind is going to be really beating these guys down necessarily, because this course is challenging enough.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because as you said, this is a very difficult course. You know, we don't have a lot of guys running away and hiding here at an event like this. Tends to be very close down the stretch. I mean, ever since they started at PGA National in 2007, the best winning score, 13 under, that was back in 2010. Last 4 years, 9 under, 6 under, 8 under, 9 under. Does that make it easier of a handicap for you to know that we're not going to get guys that go out there and post 22, 23 under? Or does it make it more challenging because, you know, it bunches up the field a little bit more?
It may really be the latter, because I think a tough course like this, I don't think it necessarily – it's not like if it's a super long course where it takes guys out of play, I think it actually brings some guys into play because it is a very challenging course. And, of course, the famous bear trap at the 15 to 17 is about as difficult as you're going to get, you know, non-majors, and even probably will be on par with some of the major championships in terms of a stretch of holes. But I do think that this brings a lot of guys in, and you were mentioning the winning scores with some of these guys. You've had your favorites win here, guys that are shorter prices. Adam Scott was only 20-1, and Sergio was right there behind him. They kind of came down to those two, and Rory McIlroy, who usually will play this event but is not because of injury this year, won at 9-1. But you've seen some bombs win at this course. Patty Harrington, of course, much to my chagrin, won the in 2015 as a 400-1. I happen to have Daniel Berger that year, who finished second. Russell Henley won at 300-1. Michael Thompson won at 300-1. So Rory Sabatini won at 80-1. So you've had some bombs win at this course. So it's not necessarily, you know, a course where you're going to get where it's biased toward favorites. So that was something I was looking at this week, because I think there'll be a lot of guys that are kind of down the board that you'll see on those first one or two pages of the leaderboard on Sunday and be like, oh, where'd this guy come from? So, I mean, it makes it, I think, more of an interesting event, rather than, you know, just having the favorite kind of run away and hide like last week. Now, I was happy with the result, but, you know, Dustin Johnson, it was pretty much he was kind of toying with the guys.
Well, and speaking of Dustin Johnson, not playing here this weekend, no Dustin Johnson, no Jordan Spieth, no Jason Day. Of course, as you mentioned, Rory McIlroy hurt. We don't have Phil Mickelson in this field. So what winds up happening when we don't have any of the big four is that these prices kind of get bunched up a little bit. You've got Adam Scott, the favorite. He's plus 1,300 at DSI, only plus 900 at Five Dimes. You got guys like Sergio, Ricky Fowler's out there. Justin Thomas, who's already won three events on this PGA Tour season, 15-1. But you've got some good players that are stuck here in the 30-40-1 range because there's no, you know, big dog to take the odds away.
Yeah, I think so. And plus some of it is maybe the market and the odds makers aren't sure where to price these guys, because you do have a fair amount of European players making their stateside debut this year or this week, because guys are going to start to come over in March to kind of get ready for the Masters and play a lot of the events on the Florida swing. Plus you have a different scheduling dynamic this year with the World Golf Championship event now in Mexico and no longer at Doral, which I think, even though I think this field is pretty good, it's still probably the weakest full field event we've had because you don't have any of the big four. And I think a lot of that is with the World Golf Championship moving from Doral, simply because you could put them back to back where the Honda is in Palm Beach and Doral obviously in Miami. So both events in South Florida, you could have guys easily play both events. But now you've got this event in Mexico, the World Golf Championship, and it almost would have made more sense from a scheduling standpoint to kind of put that right after Riviera and to kind of have that be the buffer between the California swing, the West Coast swing, and the Florida swing. But so I think that's a reason why this field is not as top-heavy, even though there's plenty of quality. But, yeah, looking at there's a lot of good price guys, 30, 40, 50, 60-1 in this event.
I think the challenging part about that is it sort of makes it a crapshoot, because you've got a lot of guys that are fairly interchangeable commodities, so to speak, and they're all priced in the same range. So that does make it a little bit difficult. I mean, especially, you know, when you talk about the European Tour players, where maybe you don't know what to expect, but you know they're really good players. A guy like Thomas Peters, for example, who was second last week, he's plus 3,500 this week. I think he was almost 100-1 or something like that last week. So a pretty significant price adjustment there on a guy like him. Now, that being said, who are you looking at this weekend?
First and foremost, I did not take, and I think you can make a case for any of the top four guys that you mentioned in the field, but I ended up not going with any of them. My lowest choice was Russell Knox, who's 28-1. He's kind of probably in between 25-30, depending on where you shop. This is more of a ball striker course that values guys that don't make a lot of mistakes and guys that hit a lot of greens, and Russell Knox checks that off. And if you look, he's played this event three times, and he's got two top threes. Lost a playoff 3 years ago to Russell Henley. Russell Knox, you know, he hasn't exactly been killing it so far this year, but he's finished top 20 in five of his six events here to start the season. Didn't play very well at Phoenix, and I didn't think that that course really fit him. But he's a guy that that really plays well here, and I think fits the marks, and he's won on some tough courses in the past. So I think you're getting a pretty fair price. I wish I would have got the 33 that he opened at most places, but, you know, 28-1, similar thing. And then the second choice, he's kind of out of form, but Daniel Berger at 33-1. Didn't play great on the West Coast swing, and that's what you'll notice with some of these guys. Some guys are better California players, and some guys are better Florida and southern part of the United States players. And I think Berger fits that. Berger very easily could have won this, lost in that playoff to Patty Harrington in 2015. And he's a kid that played at Florida State. So he got a lot of run on this course, and a lot of people kind of like him because he's played a lot of amateur and college golf rounds on this course. So course experience does matter. But the guy that I kind of circled, and if you know, I have guys ask me this all the time on Twitter, you know, who would you burn in your one and done where you can use one player a tournament? I was recommending Dustin Johnson last week at Riviera. There were some guys asking me, hey, should I burn Adam Scott here? Should I burn Sergio here? And, you know, Knox would be a guy I would consider, and also maybe Kevin Kisner would be a guy I would consider. And he's at 40-1, and he has received some early support. Really good on Bermuda greens, really likes these type of courses and the more Bermuda setup in kind of the southern part of the United States. And one of the things that really got me to liking Kisner is that he's played well this year, hasn't really contended yet for a win, but he's played well this year on courses that he usually doesn't play well on. I mean, he was fourth at the Sony, he was 10th at Pebble, he was 25th at the Career Builder. Kevin Kisner had never even had a top 10 in a West Coast event. And those aren't particularly courses he likes, with the different kind of, you know, some of the Poa Anua greens, and he said that in recent quotes. But, you know, he's getting back to, I think, courses that are more his speed, particularly with the Bermuda. But the fact that the guy has played very, very well to start the season on courses that don't really suit him, that aren't really particularly the horses for courses type of thing with him, I think makes him kind of stand out this week.
When you talk about guys that do excel at a certain course or maybe in a certain swing, you know, that aren't playing very well, you know, you talk all the time about form and guys coming into good form. Some guys, as you've talked about already here on today's segment, some guys aren't in good form, but they're coming to a course they've played very well at. Is it because of the characteristics of the course, do you think, or is it just a confidence thing of knowing, hey, I've finished, you know, in the top 10 a few times here. I'm not playing well, but I play well at this course. You know, is it a confidence thing, or is it a, you know, just the way the course sets up for guys?
I think it's actually a little bit of both. And one thing that I was reading this week, you know, and it's something that I kind of look at, the incoming form of previous winners of events. And like last year, Adam Scott came in off a second at Riviera and then won the tournament, but it was kind of an anomaly. And Rory was second at the World Match Play when he won a few years ago. But if you look at someone like the incoming form, you know, Patty Harrington, when he won, now he was like 400-1, so he was totally off the radar. He had missed three cuts and then finished 56th at Riviera 2 years ago and then wins the tournament. Russell Henley had three of four missed cuts, including at Riviera 3 years ago. And and wins this event. Michael Thompson came in missing three or four cuts and was 70 in his made cut was at 78th in San Diego. So, I mean, I think a lot of it is kind of a confidence thing. And there were a couple guys that I went with that are 66-1 that, you know, haven't won a lot. Guys that are names but haven't really been to the winner's circle a lot lately. But I think seeing this type of course is going to give them confidence. And I went with Luke Donald and Graham McDowell. And Luke is in a little bit of better form than Graham McDowell. He's got two top 25 finishes coming in, was 23rd at Pebble, was 17th last week at Riviera, and was actually up on the first page of the leaderboard for a little while in the third round on Sunday, since they played two rounds, 36 on Sunday. But, you know, guys that have great form here. I mean, you look at Donald, he's a guy that's made over $2 million in 9 appearances just in this tournament alone. And he's got a second here. He's got 4 top 10s here. He actually practices nearby at the Bear Club in Jupiter, Florida. That's actually where he played, where he had to qualify for the U.S. Open, I believe, last year or 2 years ago. You know, falling off the radar, and with the new number one, Dustin Johnson, last week, people recalled that Luke Donald was number one in the world for a while, so he kind of fell off the map, but I think he's slowly getting his confidence back, and I think he comes to a place where he has success here. So, you know, Luke Donald, I don't think is necessarily a bad place to put your money, even though it's a little scary because he hasn't won in a while. Same with Graham McDowell. 5th last year, 6th back in 2011, also has 4 top 10s here, and he's around 70-1. McDowell hasn't been in as good a form, but he's a guy that I think really likes these type of courses, and he is a grinder type of player. I mean, if you recall when he won that U.S. Open at the Olympic Club, and he's won it at the RBC, he's a guy that's won on some grinder type of courses. And, yeah, I mean, even last year with something that didn't have a lot of low scoring, I mean, he was 5th last year and he only shot 4 under. The winning score was 9 under for Adam Scott. But, you know, Graham has never been a long hitter. He's always been a pretty solid putter and a pretty solid ball striker. And he is a grinder-type player, and I think a grinder-type player can really fit and have some success at a place like PGA National.
Well, and keep in mind, too, here, if maybe you don't want to throw out a Hail Mary home run on some of these longer shot guys, some books out there do offer top 5, top 10 props. For example, Luke Donald, plus 600 at 5 dimes there to make it into the top 10. You know, there are other guys out there. Emiliano Grillo's a guy on your card. He's plus 650 to make the top 10. So there are other alternative opportunities. Wes, before we switch over to basketball here, you do have 5 long shots on your card over on Twitter. Again, that's at Wes Reynolds, the number 1. Are these guys that you like for any specific reason, or just taking some shots on some bombs? Because as we mentioned, you know, there have been some very, very long shots to win this thing recently.
Yeah, I combed through some of these. The first one, Bud Cauley. Bud Cauley is a guy that has a pretty good history on this is a Jack Nicklaus redesign. If people don't know, it was originally designed by the Fazios. But this is a guy who has played well at various Nicklaus courses. Another guy that I didn't play this week, but you're seeing get a lot of love as a former winner here, Michael Thompson, who's a guy that's played well on Nicklaus designs over the years. Guys that are a little bit down the radar. Jeff Overton is a guy put at 500-1 who's got some good finishes here. This is his last start on his major medical extension because he had a herniated disc operation over the off season, so he hasn't been a guy that played a lot of golf. But now he's kind of starting to seemingly get healthy, and this is a perfect place, I think, for a guy like Overton to really return to the tour. And if you don't want to take, you know, 300, 400, 500-1, I mean, he's a guy that I think for a top 20 prop, I could really see doing well at this event. He's got some top 10s here, and you know, actually he's got 3 top 10s here. He's only missed the cut here 3 times, 7 of 10, and the two of the missed cuts were, you know, when he just started on the tour. So he's played pretty consistently here. Will McKenzie, another guy that's got, excuse me, a couple top fives here. So there are some guys. Blaine Barber also, in some places at like five dimes, was around 300 something to one, finished third here last year. Barber is a Southern player, played at Auburn. So I think he was at Auburn or Alabama. I mix it up, but he was at one of the two, I know. So he's a guy that's played a lot of college golf in this area and some amateur golf. So, you know, there are some guys worth taking shots at. And then if you want to look at back at the Cauley angle with some of the Nicklaus designs, I mentioned Cauley, Michael Thompson, David Lingmerth is another guy with pretty good history on Nicklaus courses. So, you know, don't be afraid to take a bomb because bombs have won here before. So don't be afraid to go against the chalk so much here at this event this week.
All right, let's talk a little bit of NBA here. And I think that you had a really great golf segment there, a lot of tremendous analysis. So I certainly appreciate that, and I hope our listeners do as well. With the NBA coming out of the All-Star break here tomorrow night, what's your approach? I mean, you are a high-volume guy. You like to play small edges in hopes of gaining a big edge when, you know, you tally everything up. What do you do coming out of the All-Star break? I mean, is it just a limited exposure type of thing for you?
I'm a little bit more cautious, I think, because, you know, so you'll probably see me, if I do play, maybe some more second halves that are just more numbers type plays rather than a lot of pregame stuff, because another thing that we have to look at is that the trade deadline is tomorrow. So you're going to be, you know, you're not going to see probably a lot of pregame prices, a lot of overnights put up simply because of the deadline. And with a lot of teams rumored to be making moves, you've already seen the Cousins trade to New Orleans. There was the Lou Williams trade to Charlotte yesterday from the Lakers. I would expect you're probably going to see the bulk of the trades and the moves from these teams probably starting tonight and going in tomorrow. Make a list on your Twitter with following Adrian Wojnarowski because he's probably going to break a lot of these trades. And I mean, you know, be careful with some of the fake accounts because there are people that will have fake accounts out there putting trades out there that aren't accurate. But you're seeing a lot of teams, I think, that are going to try to make moves or maybe are a piece away. I mean, Golden State might be the only team, really, or maybe San Antonio, that aren't necessarily looking to make moves. But you've already seen Toronto get Serge Ibaka. You've seen the Cousins deal. You know, it's going to be interesting to see what some of these contenders that may be like a piece away. I mean, we saw Cleveland get Kyle Korver, you know, a couple months ago. You know, it's going to be interesting to see if Boston makes a move, if some of these teams in the West make a move, maybe Houston or even San Antonio. Some of these big free agents that are going to be in the last year of their contract that haven't necessarily said they're going to sign an extension. We're dealing with one in Indianapolis with Paul George, who I don't think is going to end up being traded, but certainly there's some things being bandied about. So to go back to your question, I think maybe for the first few days, it's probably good to exercise caution. And I think that's kind of true almost with any sport, with baseball, because you know, when you get guys off longer rest than usual, guys that maybe that are on their usual 5 days, every 5 days, may have not pitched for a week and a half or 2 weeks. So I always think it's kind of good to kind of really exercise caution out of All-Star breaks in general.
One clarification I do want to make, Lou Williams went to Houston, not to Charlotte. I know Charlotte was the original rumor. Then he winds up.
Yeah, okay,
the
that's right. That's well, right. I totally forgot about that because I actually sent a tweet out saying, okay, now with Lou Williams there, they're going to shoot 53s a game instead of 43s a game. I don't know why I thought Charlotte, so thank you for clarifying that.
No problem. I mean, I think that was kind of the expectation, and then I noticed that as well, that he wound up going to Houston and not Charlotte. But let's talk about that for a second because Lou Williams is a guy that was the Lakers' leading scorer, even though he was coming off of the bench. I think he started one game for them, but that was a role that Luke Walton liked him, you know, coming in there at the first opportunity, and then obviously he was very successful with that. Do you know what his role is going to be like for the Rockets here? I mean, if he keeps coming off the bench, that should be a fairly seamless transition, right?
You would think, but if you look at there's already kind of somebody in his role who I think is a better player than him, and that's Eric Gordon, who won the 3-point shootout. So that makes me think, is somebody going to move from Houston? I mean, they have a lot of shooters on that team. You know, you look at also Ryan Anderson, who will take a fair amount of threes. Obviously, James Harden's going to get his shots. And then you have Trevor Ariza. You know, so you got a lot of guys that are going to throw the ball up. I mean, and that's typical for a Mike D'Antoni coach team. But I'm going to be interested to see, because Houston, by and large, has a lot of similar players, and then they'll have somebody like Patrick Beverley, who plays the more defensive stopper pest role, who isn't necessarily known as a great shooter. So, you know, I'm interested to see if Houston maybe makes a move with one of those players, or if they're just adding a piece here and say, okay, we just need a guy that's going to get buckets, and that's what we're going to have to do, is try to outscore teams, that's the only way we can really win, because we're not going to be a really good defensive team. So, you know, I'm interested to see if they kind of stand pat with that and just kind of put him in like a co-role a little bit with Eric Gordon. It could also be an insurance policy, because this is really about one of the only years Eric Gordon's really ever stayed healthy. And you've seen him be effective as kind of that six-man and instant offense guy off the bench. But Eric has a history of knee problems and injuries. So this could be maybe more of an insurance policy for Gordon.
What I was hoping to show there, and I think you made some really good points, is the dichotomy between a deal like that, where you get more or less a supplementary player, a complementary player that, you know, can complement somebody that is in the starting lineup, and then you go to a change like Lou Williams, with something like New Orleans, where you've got a superstar that wants the ball in DeMarcus Cousins. You've got two guys now, Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins, that really want the ball. They want it down low. They want to be able to make things happen there. Seems like that would be a much bigger transition for a team to work in somebody that's such a high usage type of player like Cousins.
Yeah, I think it's a way bigger transition. I mean, predictably, they're going to try to have Anthony Davis play more of the four, you know, stretch four, but not necessarily just stretch four as a shooter. I mean, he certainly will be able to get touches in the post at times and down on the block. But, you know, this is something that's a transition, I think, for New Orleans, at least for the short term, which is the last couple months of the season. It's going to take a while, I think, for them to kind of fit together with the other guys. But I think they're almost, you know, doing this to say who can lose less games and get in the eighth spot, because there's a big difference down to that eighth spot, which I think New Orleans was there and Sacramento was there and Denver and Dallas has kind of come up a little bit after a horrible start. So it's almost like this is just kind of the year where, hey, let's get in the playoffs, let's see what we can do, and then let's look at the off season to see if we can re-sign Cousins or what we can bring in to kind of make this Cousins-Davis lineup work. If we bring in a better shooter at a two guard or a small forward position, if we change point guards, because I think Drew Holiday is a free agent over the summer. So, I mean, that is I think a much bigger transition than if you're adding, you know, a guy off the bench or if the Pacers, who've been in trying to get a big guy, you know, bring in a big guy who can play defense and rebound off the bench. So, I mean, you're going to see a lot of those type of deals. I don't know how many real superstars you're going to get traded. Certainly Carmelo and all these guys are being bantied about. But, to go back to your basic question, I think this New Orleans transition, it is going to take, I think, 2 or 3 weeks to really kind of get these guys together. But are they less bad than the other teams to where they can kind of get through that and still get the eighth spot? And that's kind of what I see for New Orleans there.
One thing I want to ask you about on the college basketball side here, we've got Lunardi and Palm and all these guys that are, you know, really earning their salaries here over the next 3 weeks or so. We've got projections out from the selection committee, at least for the first 16 seeds in the tournament. As you're looking around the college basketball betting market here, and as I talked about with my pro handicappers yesterday, we've got a lot more public involvement here this time of the year as we get closer to March Madness. The NBA All-Star break allows some people to come back to the college basketball side. Has it changed your approach at all with, you know, teams experiencing pressure that aren't used to experiencing it, all this bubble talk? Do you alter anything that you do personally?
Well, I mean, I think it could potentially provide a little bit of value, because I think a lot of this stuff, first four in or last four in, first four out, I think this stuff does get priced into the market. I mean, these bookmakers, you know, they're not dummies. They consume the information that we get, and you know, sometimes they'll price that stuff in the market, and you know, that's something I think that you have to consider, because teams that are kind of in like must win games, because you're on ESPN or all the Fox Sports One or CBS Sports Network, you'll hear all the guys, oh, they need this win, they're right on the bubble, and you know, teams don't always win must win games. And that's something to definitely keep in mind. You know, there are going to be teams that are going to play their way in, and there are going to be teams that play their way out. So, you know, that's going to be, I think, very much priced in the market. And I think typically with where you're looking at your more recreational bettors, they're, I think, more prone or apt to bet on the team that's in the must-win situation than necessarily go against. So, you know, some of those teams I look to go against. I mean, it's just like when you get these smaller conference tournaments that are starting in these one-bid leagues, not all the number one seeds are going to win these tournaments. That's why they have these automatic bids into the NIT. So these one seeds, you'll see some of them get knocked out in the quarterfinals or in the semifinals. And you'll see a team that maybe is a 6 or a 7 seed in these conference tournaments end up putting 3-4 days together and winning and getting in the tournament with maybe 500 records. I think you saw that. I don't know if it was last year or the year before with Holy Cross in the Patriot League. They were the 9 seed. And everybody was thinking Lehigh or Bucknell, who are the two best programs in the league, but it ended up being Holy Cross going to the tournament. So, you know, keep in mind, you know, that's one of the things that makes this time of year exciting. There's going to be upsets, and there's going to be teams that you think have no chance to win these conference tournaments and then end up getting the automatic bids.
Really strong segment today with Wes Reynolds. You can follow him and his work on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, thank you so much, man. We'll talk to you again next week.
Adam, always a pleasure.
Great stuff there with Wes Reynolds covering three very different, very unique sports betting markets. As I said at the top of the show, coming up here on our Thursday edition, our Thursday meeting show, Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com, and then also Ralph Michaels from WagerTalk.com. So a lot more college basketball insight coming your way on tomorrow's show. One final thing I want to say to our listeners here today, if you get the opportunity, please head on over to BangTheBook.com. We've got some great writing going on. Myself and my colleagues, we're doing some great stuff with previews. I've got some Major League Baseball things going on over there. I put up my NBA situational betting article yesterday. To take a look here at this abbreviated week in the association. Lots of great stuff over there. You can get these shows as segments over at bangthebook.com. You can also find us on Spreaker where we post the segments. I know sometimes there have been some volume concerns here with some people. I do amplify the volume with those separate segments. So if that's something that's a little bit better for you, that option is out there both at Spreaker and over at bangthebook.com. So I'll do it for today. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.